This is Obscured, the podcast from Cuvenda Media about critical issues that don't get much attention because they're complex, overshadowed, and unfold largely out of the public eye. On this limited series, From Words to Weapons, we're focused on survivors of law enforcement trauma. I'm Emily Previty.
And I'm Stephanie Marudis. On this episode, we're bringing you a panel discussion about supporting survivors of violence. The conversation focuses on how policy takes shape to support survivors of violence, how the definition of crime versus violence can affect whether someone qualifies for support, and the impact of the Victims of Crime Act, or what's known as VOCA. We'll also hear about various challenges, including funding cuts and how violence often goes underreported, as well as policy solutions. The panel discussion was hosted by the Women of Fells at the University of Pennsylvania's Fells Institute of Government and presented in partnership with the Anti-Violence Partnership of Philadelphia, Morgan State University's Department of Nursing, and Obscured.
Our panelists are Adara Combs, who is the victim advocate in Philadelphia and a former prosecutor in the district attorney's office, Jolly Hatchett, who's chair of the Citizens Police Oversight Commission, or CPOC, in Philly, where he's also an attorney specializing in employment, civil rights, and municipal liability cases, after also working as a city prosecutor, and Maya Anderson, who runs the graduate and undergraduate nursing programs at Morgan State. Maya's also a forensic nurse and sexual assault nurse examiner. The seventh episode in our series focused on Maya's work developing a protocol for caring for survivors of law enforcement trauma. Episode 5 focused on accountability and delved into CPOC's work toward that end. In this episode, the conversation you'll hear is moderated by Natasha Daniela De Lima Micklin, Executive Director of the Anti-Violence Partnership of Philadelphia.
I'm very honored to welcome you all to tonight's discussion. It's very crucial, very timely, on the evolving landscape of violence and victimization. We have gathered with us today a distinguished group of leaders representing government, healthcare, and law to shed light on the intricate web of challenges faced by victims of violence and the policies that shape their support systems. Violence is an unfortunate reality that permeates our society. And just this past week, what should have been a jubilant celebration for the Kansas City Chiefs winning Super Bowl 58, that became a horrific nightmare after a dispute among several people ended in gunfire that killed one person, injured 22, half of whom were under the age of 16, and traumatized an entire nation. Understanding the complexities of violence and the trauma from our exposure to violence, whether directly or indirectly, is crucial for crafting effective policies that address the needs of not just victims, but everyone. So our panelists, they bring a wealth of knowledge and experience to the table, offering perspectives from various disciplines to provide a comprehensive understanding of the issues at hand. In our discussion, we will dive into the nuances of victimization and explore the ways in which policy can be shaped to support victims of violence. We will explore the role of government, their initiatives, and the impact of funding sources such as the Federal Victims of Crime Act, VOCA. And we will confront the stark realities of challenges such as funding cuts or underreporting of violence and other obstacles that hinder the effectiveness of our support system. This is not just a conversation amongst experts. We do want this to be an open and inclusive dialogue. So when there is a point during tonight's discussion, we will open it up to the audience. We do encourage you to participate. We want to hear what you have to say. And so as we navigate through these critical topics today, let's strive for an open, constructive, and inclusive conversation. So without further ado, let's begin this important conversation. And so I'm going to start with you, Adara. If we could start with defining, what is the difference between a victim of a crime and a victim of violence?
Thank you, Natasha. And first of all, good evening. Thank you all for coming on a Friday evening for this conversation. It's a very important conversation, I think, to all of us, but also to our community as a whole. Just hearing about what took place after the Super Bowl and knowing the state of our city, I think it's not arguable that this issue is something we absolutely should be discussing on every day of the week, including the weekend, including Friday. So we certainly are appreciative of all of you being here to be a part of this conversation. So to answer your question, I think it's a very important distinction. And just in full candor, my training is as an attorney. So while I'm the victim advocate for the city of Philadelphia, my background is as a prosecutor and a licensed attorney in both Pennsylvania and New Jersey. So I look at these things from a very different lens because of that legal background. So with that being said, a crime victim is someone that's defined as someone who has been harmed either financially, physically, emotionally, some instances, sexually by someone who has committed a crime. And by when I say crime, I mean a codified crime. So when you look in your crimes code, and every state has one, the Pennsylvania crimes code, it identifies what a crime is and what qualifies as a crime. So you can think of a homicide, you can think of an assault, a theft, a robbery, a sexual assault, domestic violence, harassment, terroristic threats. Those are all codified crimes. So when you're talking about a victim of crime, you're talking about someone who has been harmed by someone who has committed one of those codified crimes. Now, when we think about that and we take off our courtroom hats, our attorney hats, so on and so forth, and you look at someone who has been harmed by violence, that doesn't necessarily mean that it's a codified crime, right? That doesn't mean that someone is able to be arrested for that act as much as they have been harmed in any of those ways, whether it be financial, physical, emotional, sexual. Those things may not be codified, but they are harms to a person and therefore can be qualified as violence against another.
Are there challenges in defining and categorizing incidents as violence for the purpose of providing support?
Absolutely. One of the biggest obstacles I feel, both as a practitioner, but also as a citizen and a community member, is that so many services require qualification by way of entrance into some formal system. And what I mean by that is a lot of times your ability to obtain services is tethered to whether or not you meet the qualifications. So has someone been arrested? Did a crime occur? Those very much so link individuals to the availability of services, whether it be financial services, whether it be restitution by way of the court, whether that be certain qualifying emotional supports, so on and so forth. That very much so matters in terms of whether or not someone may be eligible for those services. So I think it's really important when you look at what's available to the community to remember that not everybody who endures harm has endured harm that qualifies as a crime. But that does not mean that they don't need those additional supports and services. So it's important to look at those distinctions and really think about what's the goal of what we're trying to do, right? What are we trying to accomplish within our community? And then you begin to look at whether or not it really matters if something was a crime or whether it wasn't. Does that mean that person is any less worthy of counseling services? Does it mean they're any less worthy of being made financially whole? Does it mean they're any less worthy of feeling safe within their skin, within their community, within their home? And I think that's the distinction that oftentimes creates challenges when you're talking about services to individuals who have been harmed.
So Maya, you are a healthcare practitioner. Can you also shed some insight a little bit more?
Yes, I can. So in addition to teaching nurses, I also work as a forensic nurse. My particular area, my population of interest is in victims of law enforcement violence, having been one myself. Quite frankly, when patients present to the emergency department, we have models of care for victims of other types of violence. So victims of sexual assault, victims of intimate partner violence, victims or elder abuse, child abuse, sexual abuse. But if you have someone who presents to an emergency department and says, the police beat me up, I need services, I need care, they're not necessarily considered victims. And so they don't have access to the same resources that other victims may have access to.
So in an instance, for example, if you are a victim of law enforcement violence, you go to the hospital, what then are the support structures that exist? So if your perpetrator is law enforcement?
They don't exist. There's a gap in care. I'll give you a perfect example. I was taking care of a patient who met criteria of a sex worker. She was under arrest. She came in under arrest, but she made an allegation while she was there that the police had beat her up, that they had been in a fight. She was covered in bruises. The police were there with her. And as the nurse, I was taking care of her. I was there to collect evidence relative to the sexual assault, but I also needed to collect evidence based on what she said. But who do I give the evidence to? How do I record it? Who do I give the evidence to? And when it's time for her to be discharged, where is she going to go? Whose custody is she going to be in? Those sorts of things are what we consider gaps in care that need to be addressed from the healthcare perspective.
Adara, in your role as the city's victim advocate, in instances where victims, they don't feel comfortable reporting to law enforcement, what, like in your experience, what supports are there?
So that's a very interesting question, because I think the primary question that you always have to ask is the goal to report it, period, because that is a choice that everyone has, or is it an apprehension and a fear that we can kind of work around, right? So a lot of times my office gets contacts from community members who, quite frankly, have mistrust of law enforcement. They don't want to interact with law enforcement by themselves for whatever reason, either because they've fallen victim previously or because of the community relationship that exists between law enforcement and community and the mistrust that's there. And a lot of times my office will act as somewhat of a liaison between them. So it's not foreign for us to work on behalf of someone with law enforcement to create an environment where they're able to have the necessary conversations, but not be alone in that circumstance. So I think the question is, do they want those types of supports or they don't want those types of supports? And they're looking for the internal healing. So they're looking for counseling. They're looking for safety. So, you know, maybe relocation services. Are they looking to be connected with therapy and things of the sort? So I think it depends on what their desire is in terms of how my office or offices like mine can support them.
What you just said, though, you just touched upon relocation. That is something that would be eligible to a victim of a crime. So what's the eligibility distinction if you are a victim of a violence versus if you're a victim of a crime?
It honestly depends on where the funding comes from. And I think that's a big part of what, you know, you and I often dialogue about when it comes to different issues within victim services. It really depends on what the funding says, right? So is the funding indicating that an arrest has to be made? Then obviously there has to be a crime committed. Is it that it was reported? Is it that the person is cooperative? So there are a lot of different things that can come into play. Fortunately enough for my office, we've developed a program that is geared towards those individuals who may not be as willing to participate in the legal process, in the prosecution process, in order to receive those services. There's no tethering to that. So as long as there is a harm to their life, as long as they're in imminent danger, we're able to provide services because our funding is not linked to that type of requirement, which can be limiting in nature because you can understand conceptually and actually why someone may not want to, you know, go to law enforcement and why they may not want to participate in the prosecution process. Retaliation is real. People are afraid. So to continue to perpetuate a system that ignores that is to continue to perpetuate a system that isn't particularly helpful to the community.
I think something that we also, we had a discussion before, also recognizing that victimization has become so nuanced that something that might be perceived as is clearly an act of violence, but it's not considered a crime. Case in point, our organization, Anti-Violence Partnership in Philadelphia, we're one of seven victim service agencies in the city, and we serve youth, adults, and families and communities that have been impacted by violence. And a couple of years ago, we had a school reach out to us, and there was a middle-aged student woke up in the middle of the night. Apparently, their family members were engaged in illicit drug activity. So a kid wakes up in the middle of the night and there's a SWAT team in their room pointing guns at them. So this is a middle school child, right? Very traumatizing. But did a crime occur? No, right? But did something violent and traumatizing occur? Absolutely. So they called us, our organization, and they asked us, you know, can we provide services to the kid? If we were just sticking with one type of funding, we can't do that, right? So that goes over. I think that really is illustrating the point of all these nuances. You know, I guess my other question too is like, all right, so you said that your office has now created this program. Are we seeing other types of strategies that can be taken to address that, navigate that mistrust, right? If victims are not going to report willingly to law enforcement, what other solutions or strategies are there or alternatives? Maybe Jolly, I might pivot this one to you.
Right. And I'm certainly happy to chime in on that. I think that, and this is the classic lawyer's answer, I'll borrow that from Adara, but it depends, right? And so a lot of times what I deal with is civil litigation for individuals that have maybe been involved with excessive force from police departments, and they then bring a lawsuit. Or on the other hand, in one of my other hats that I wear, I'm the chair of the Citizens Police Oversight Commission, where we oftentimes deal with individuals that may, in theory, or actually have been victimized or feel like they've been victimized at the hands of law enforcement. And this, I don't want to jump ahead, but it touches on one of the other topics where if there's institutional distrust. And so how do those individuals who are victims, how do they then navigate the act of being victimized? And so one of the things, at least with CPOC, through that legislation, it provides and gives it, we say it gives it more teeth than the prior iteration of the organization that it was, to look and to investigate and to make meaningful recommendations to the police department, as well as the district attorney and city council if necessary. So when you ask the question in terms of when individuals are victimized, what recourse do they have? That's at least one scenario, but it depends. Anecdotally, just going back to, and I think it's definitely a distinction that should be made, and also it furthers the conversation. When you talk about crime versus violence, When you think of, let's say, in the worst case scenario, there's a homicide. The decedent is, in fact, the victim of a crime. However, you have their family and all of the familial relationships that they have, whereas though they weren't the ones who were shot or killed, but they were the victims of violence, right? So then again, touching on the other thing that was raised in terms of what resource might be available to them. And I think, or at least in my experience previously being a prosecutor, I think that what I've seen is the further you get away from the individual that was the actual victim of crime, the less resources that may be available.
One of the other things we see too, right? So a surviving family member or friend of someone who's died by homicide, that's called a co-victim of homicide. But what about the surviving family members of the perpetrator, the person who had perpetrated the violent incident? Oftentimes, it's equally as traumatizing to them, too.
And again, as a prosecutor, I mean, it was never lost on me. Anytime that there's a homicide, particularly, it's a lose-lose situation, right? Because worst case scenario, the decedent is gone, they're dead, their family is victimized. You get a conviction, someone is going to jail at 20 to 40 years or whatever the case may be. That family is also victimized in a sense that, sure, you did the crime, you do the time. But now let's say, and these are real scenarios, but let's say the individual who did the crime has a 6-month-old child. So then there's now an absence of, it could be a man or a woman, there's the absence of that individual. And so there's an act of violence that now it's perpetuated amongst both families. So you see that as well, or I've seen that as well.
Unfortunately, there's a common saying in our world that hurt people. And we see that a lot, that if we were to intervene, if mom is grieving the loss of her son, but mom also has other children and those children, now they lost their older sibling. Well, what if we were to intervene and support mom, and maybe mom can be a stronger mother for the rest of the children?
So I just wanted to add to that, just from a government standpoint, within the city of Philadelphia, there's a particular entity within the managing director's office, the criminal justice public safety cluster is what we call it. And within our cluster, the very goal of all of the work that we do is to be as holistic as what you're referencing. So there's our office, the Office of Victim Advocate. There's the Office of Reentry Partnership, which primarily focuses on individuals coming back into the community from incarceration. There's the Office of Violence Prevention that also houses GVI, which I'm not sure if anyone has seen the city council testimony regarding. But the very purpose of all of those offices is to be holistic in the approach in terms of how we help the community recover from acts of violence, really no matter what lane in which they're approaching it. So the GVI program, Group Violence Intervention, focuses on just that, on putting resources within the community that doesn't necessarily focus on, or really doesn't matter who perpetrated the harm versus who was the victim, as much as providing resources to everybody that's in need of those resources. And I think the importance of looking at it in that approach is because, to your point, hurt people. And if you only service one of those populations, you're going to continue to perpetuate the cycle of harm. Whereas if you identify why that happened and try to solve that while also providing services to the community or the individual that's harmed, it takes an approach that has a widespread reach with the hopes, hopefully remediating the crux of it in the community.
So you had touched upon it before, and I think I'm going to like now expand upon it. The challenges. A lot of this type of work, though, there is something that is preventing it from being done at the scale that it needs to be done. And that word is funding. Mm-hmm. So in Adara, I'm looking at you. Like, can you expand like what these funding challenges are in particular for victims?
Absolutely. So there's one question that we were discussing about some recent decisions that were made in terms of funding cuts that are going to happen statewide, but are certainly going to impact us here in Philadelphia to the tune of $605,000. And I feel like I remember that number because I've written it so many times in the last couple of weeks trying to advocate to fill that gap. But yeah, within the next year, we're going to see over $500,000 less within our community as we continue to see violence perpetuated in our communities. And the problem with that is that all of our funding is linked to something bigger, right? So when you think about funding locally, you're also looking at state. When you're looking at the state, you're looking at the federal government. When you're looking at the federal government, you're looking at how they get their money also, which is also linked to policies. It's linked to legislation. It's linked to decisions by folks that are not necessarily the people within our communities that are being victimized. So the problem is that you're right, Natasha, there's not enough money to do the things that we know will work if we had the capacity to spread them wider, if we had the capacity to hire more people to do them, to pay competitively, to put the money back into the communities. And quite honestly, it comes down to what folks are prioritizing and what's being advocated for. And right now, I mean, our office, as well as The Nancy Balance Partnership is working together along with other Philadelphia agencies to ensure that what we need is being advocated for and the money is being put where it needs to be put, because that's the biggest challenge, right? Everybody supports the good cause. And so pen meets paper and the decisions are made and the votes happen. What we saw last year is that everybody was, you know, for supporting victims until it came time to put it in the budget. So we're constantly encouraging folks to remain involved in those types of decisions to ensure that we're holding our legislators, our city council, our mayor, our state representatives accountable for the fact that we need the money to do the work that you say you want us to do. And if you say you want us to do it, you have to provide the resources. I'm constantly saying that Victim Services is one of the only entities I've ever engaged with in my career that continues to service no matter what, no matter the funding, and they're continue to expect to perform because people are going to continue to come to your door and you don't want to turn them away and you can't turn them away. But if the pot keeps going down, the services will too. And eventually they'll disappear if the funding sources aren't there. So those are the challenges that we face in Victim Services, because it's all related to dollars. The will is there, the ability is there, the knowledge is there, the research is there, but none of that means anything. You can't pay for it.
The big challenge that we're also seeing, right? Like, so for victim service providers throughout Pennsylvania and actually throughout the country, right? We are largely funded by the Victims of Crime Act, VOCA. And with the last presidential administration, we saw dramatic decreases to the Crime Victims Fund. Crime Victims Fund is what funds, every single state has their own Crime Victims Fund. And that's like, so for example, if you are a victim of a crime, you're eligible for certain benefits, loss of wages, bereavement assistance, you know, funeral, crime scene cleanup. And so what we're seeing now because of these dramatic decreases is that where we are right now with VOCA, folks might not be able to get the compensation. And so victim service providers, we're now having to see these dramatic decreases to our funding. But the funding itself is an issue too, because the funding itself is very specific. You have to be a direct victim of a crime in order to be eligible for service. So the example that we gave earlier, the student experiencing police violence, if we had provided a therapist to the student, it couldn't be VOCA funded. So now you're seeing all of these different victim service providers throughout the country. We have to diversify our funding. And the problem also therein is that the pot of money is very small. It's very competitive. Does anyone else want to chime in about funding? I can pivot now to maybe legislation, right? Now, if we're looking at the funding issues, you know, legislatively, what can we be doing? And Jolly, I do want to bring this back to you, because the CPOC was something that was formed here in Philadelphia pursuant to city council resolution.
Correct. If the question is legislatively, some things that have been done, but I think that there's always more that can be done, because there's certainly, we continue to see a gap in terms of victimization and victims of violence. But CPOC, the Citizens Police Oversight Commission, was born directly out of legislation from Philadelphia City Council. And that was directly as a result of the death of George Floyd. One of the things that all across the country, but more particularly here in Philadelphia, citizens were calling for and demanding for more accountability of law enforcement officers. And especially, again, that was one of the ultimate forms of victimization. And so it was put on a ballot and passed on a ballot. And so the prior version or iteration of the organization was the Police Advisory Board, which a lot of people, the criticism, one of the main criticisms of that form of the organization was that it had no teeth. When I say it has no teeth, the organization could not do investigations. They could make recommendations, but there was not a need or requirement that the police commissioner respond to a recommendation. So as part of the legislation, and it's a very dense legislation, it's great legislation, but one of the downsides is that it's going to take time to build out. So when we talk about just the legislation, it's one thing to pass the legislation, but we also have to get it right. And the analogy that I sometimes use when talking about CPOC and legislation in general was like, you have a 16-year-old just passed their driver's license and like, great job. Here's a Ferrari. Good luck. And so it's this great form of legislation and has the teeth and the power to do so much, but it's basically 3 years old. And so what do you expect a three-year-old to do at that stage? When we think of actually humans who were like phenomenal and great beings, but as a human at 3 years old is just learning to really walk and talk, and they have the rest of their life to perfect that. So when we think about an organization who's not as advanced as we see human beings, but from an organization perspective, it has a lot to do. There's a lot of work to do, but the work that it is doing is allowing, again, when we're talking about individuals who have been victimized and don't want to go to the police, because a lot of times what we hear is, if I've been victimized by the police, and it makes a lot of sense, why am I going to go to Philadelphia Internal Affairs Department to report the victimization? And so now the legislation of CPOC provides another avenue for individuals to report crimes of anything as it relates to police. And the organization has also made recommendations, since it has now been CPOC. It makes recommendations to the district attorney's office to call for criminal charges or other measures to be taken as a result of the investigations. Now, it's not perfect. Here's the downside to the legislation and organization as it stands at 3 years old. It hasn't been built out as far as the finances, right? Everything comes back to funding. As far as the finances that it needs in order to hire so many investigators, because when you think of, if we completely divert, which the organization at some point will, divert any and all citizens' complaints from Philadelphia Internal Affairs to CPOC, Philadelphia Internal Affairs Department is fully staffed with chief inspectors and captains and so forth and so on. They're fully staffed, but CPOC is not. So as the organization grows, the hope is that as a result of the legislation, it's able to fully take on all of the complaints from the Philadelphia Police Department, so that victims won't have to be doubly victimized, right? Have to go and experience some kind of traumatic incident with a law enforcement officer. And then now you have to go back and report it to them at some point. And I've seen it, I've heard it, I've lived it. You're like, I won't even bother. Forget about it. And which is the worst thing that we want to happen. We don't want individuals who have been victimized to say, forget about it. The other aspect of it is there has been legislation within, I think, the past 3 or 4 years signed by Governor Wolf called Act 57, which now makes it a requirement for law enforcement departments to self-report into a central database regarding members that have left or are leaving their department. What does that mean? You can have a law enforcement officer who's under investigation for excessive force against a citizen. The investigation finds that the officer committed whatever the act is, but we're XYZ Police Department. We're going to I'm sorry, she gave me a 30-second mark. We're XYZ Police Department. We're going to allow you to resign in lieu of termination. And nobody has to know. Not now. The legislation requires that that be reported to the central database based on Act.
Actually, you know what? I can ask a question that will just take it down. So what do you feel are the most glaring challenges for progress?
I think that there is, honestly, a lack of, I don't necessarily want to call it awareness, but for lack of a better term, I'll call it awareness. And awareness in the sense that there's not enough emphasis or urgency, lack of urgency. I like that better. There's a lack of urgency when it comes to the finances and the level of attention and care and resources that need to be dedicated to victims. And again, I think that the term victim in and of itself, which is a conversation that we're having, it has to be broadened, because it's not just a victim of a crime who maybe had suffered violence, right? You also had to think of the holistic approaches, which what Adara Combs said, we got to think about on both sides, the perpetrator of the violence and the individual who was victimized by the violence. Because at some point, hurt people hurt other people, and then other people who were hurt, that's also triggered something. So I think that there's a lack of urgency.
This is a really, it's not a loaded question, but it's one that we could take an hour talking about in and of itself. It's something that I think of every day as it's a part of my work. I think there are a number of issues that will hinder progress or have hindered progress, and obviously hopeful that that won't continue to be the case, especially, you know, currently in the city experiencing a new administration. But one of them is obviously funding, which is something we've talked about. In Philadelphia specifically, as it pertains to victim services, one of the biggest obstacles that I look at often is the disproportionate funding that happens amongst victim service agencies. And I'm of the opinion that it shouldn't matter what zip code your crime occurs in. It shouldn't matter where you live. You should receive similar services, and those should be funded similarly. And you should have access to similar things, no matter whether you live in Germantown like I do, or if you live in some other area of the city. But with that being said, it all comes down to dollars. And it comes down to allocating the money where it's needed to be to do the work that is necessary and that the community continues to see is helpful to them. But in addition to that, it also requires being creative, but also being strategic. And I think a lot of times those two things are at odds when it comes time to implementing policies and implementing procedures and programs within, you know, just thinking of the city. You know, knowing that there are so many different avenues that we're trying to travel at the same time, but all of them are not being equally traveled. They're not being equally funded. They're not being equally supported, but they're expected to be equally successful. And I think that that is extremely problematic because it leads to, again, disproportionate outcomes because of disproportionate resources. But I think also what's important is to engage the community. And as long as when we engage the community, we're doing so from a, I'll use an anecdote. So when my office first opened, I would go to community events, I would convene community members, and I would ask them, like, what is it that you think would be helpful? And a lot of times what I would receive is messages of disenchantment, quite honestly, because they're like, you know, people come here, they ask us what we want, and then nothing ever happens. Or what we want is morphed into something that we didn't ask for. Or our words and desires are then spun to not assist us, but rather to continue to create obstacles and barriers within our communities. So I think it's important to engage the community in a meaningful way, and not doing so creates obstacles because you begin implementing things that nobody asked for or versions of things that nobody wants. So I think it's important to do that because as long as we don't, we will be barriers to the progress of the community as a whole. And that's the goal. You know, it's not the progress of my office. It's not the progress of CPAC. It's not the progress of any health institution. It's the progress and betterment of the community as a whole.
From a healthcare perspective, reframing the narrative and how we look at our patients, looking at them as patients, taking care of them as patients, no matter how they present, we started the conversation within forensic nursing. Right around the time the George Floyd incident, Emily has been following us as we worked on developing a model of care for victims of violence, of law enforcement violence specifically, and presenting it. The conversations have been really hard within forensic nursing, understanding that this is, you know, a particular population that we may not have recognized as victims of violence, and we're looking at them as criminals. So reframing how we look at them and how we provide care, disassociating, not necessarily from law enforcement, when they present in the acute setting in the ED for care, and helping the patient recognize that I'm your nurse, I'm taking care of you. This is what I'm here to do. I'm on your side. So you can build that trust so that they can get the things that they need from you in that space where they are.
What are sources of encouragement that you are seeing in your respective fields? And Maya, I'm going to actually stay with you. Besides
other
the work
colleagues
that you're doing,
that are actually recognizing the work. I think I've been a nurse for a long time. I'm not even going to say how long. When I started in the emergency department in Chicago and I was seeing it back then, there weren't a lot of nurses like me. The nurses that I worked with like me that took care of these patients, that understood, you know, what we needed to do to take care of the patients, there was not a lot of recognition. But I think as we've evolved, there are more nurses like me that are speaking up and saying that we need this. And so that's...
I would say that my biggest source of encouragement in this role is seeing the impact in real time in the moment that supportive services can have with individual community members. So my day is best when, despite the fact that obviously someone makes their way to my office, something has happened and that something is not good. But when I'm able to say, actually, what you need is something I can provide because I do have the resources to provide that thing. And I'm able to turn something that was otherwise the worst incident of their life, quite possibly, and provide some support that is meaningful, rooted in what they actually desire, and helping them to turn a chapter or page to another chapter in their life. That's my source of encouragement because it shows me that the creation of the office was not in vain. Being in this position was not in vain. And that it actually is having impact in people's lives and they can feel it, especially, you know, when it comes down to our relocation program, being able to say, yeah, you didn't qualify for those other services, but you qualify for ours. So you find a place, we'll pay for it. And they're like, wait, what? And I'm like, yep, we'll pay for it. Let's go. And being able to move people to safety when they thought that they were going to be living in danger because no one was able to help them.
How do you follow that, right? My source of encouragement just comes from the fact that there are things being done, be it incremental or exponential. Incremental in the sense that there's funding, but then it's like, well, the funding is being reduced. Exponential in the sense that, well, this organization didn't exist before, or there was a lesser version of the organization. Now there's this greater version of the organization. So the fact that things are in place and things are being done is better than, I always tell people when we talk about especially police reform and police oversight, that okay, it's not perfect, but it's better than having nothing. So that's what gives me inspiration and what keeps me excited about being involved in this aspect of the work.
Do you guys want to open it up to the audience?
Is it that time already?
It's that time, but we'll open it to the audience, I think, for a few, and then we'll circle back.
Well, while we wait for questions from the audience, I have a question for Dr. Meyer. In terms of your work dealing with victims, what keeps you motivated, right? I know we talked about what gives you inspiration, but what keeps you motivated? What's one of the things at the end of the day, after you're dealing with somebody, that makes you say, you know what, it was worth it. I want to keep at it.
The patience. I mean, that's what I got into it for, the patience.
How y'all doing, everyone? Y'all did a wonderful job. I just wanted to add, everything was well said. And the question I got is for all three of you guys. What led you to, I guess, your passion and your career?
I think that there's a saying that I heard, you know, when you're doing God's work, or when you're doing the work that God meant for you, you'll just know it and you'll be pulled to it or called to it. I think that people oftentimes ask me, well, what would I have done if I wasn't in the role that I am? And I don't think that there's a scenario where I do anything different. I didn't go seeking to be, I didn't want to be a lawyer, I promise you. The recession happened. It was either go to the Army, go to the state police, or go to law school. I failed the state police exam, so I said, law school is it. But in doing that, again, honestly, I was drawn to that. And then also being a prosecutor, just from different life experiences that I had, for me, honestly, and as corny as it is, it was a joke. It was the best job I ever quit. But one of the things in which I got so much satisfaction out of it, because I got to provide a voice for victims. And in this city, but all across the country, if you are a defendant and you are charged with a crime, the Constitution is made and geared towards the defendant. The right to remain silent, the right to an attorney, the right to this, that, and the other, a fair trial. But if you are a victim, there are very few rights that victims have in the space of a criminal prosecution or being victims. And in fact, the only real right that a victim has comes after a conviction, where they have a right to give a victim impact speech. So for me, I always told myself, and I found so much gratification in the fact that somebody can go and hire the best criminal defense attorney that there is in the city of Philadelphia, but they can't hire the best prosecutor. So knowing that, I was good at what I did. So knowing that and continue to do that, I knew that I would fight for the victims of the city of Philadelphia and give them the best representation that money couldn't buy.
Okay. It's funny because we come from the same office. So I, too, feel like being a prosecutor was one of the best positions that I've ever left. But I left it for a role that I find to be gratifying in a different way. So to answer the actual question, the reason why this became my passion is because I grew up in Philly. And obviously evident by my appearance before you, I am a Black woman and have navigated the terrain of being on this side in terms of familiar relationships, friends, whatever, having family members that have been killed and have been victimized, but also having family members that have matriculated through the criminal justice system as perpetrators of crime as well. And I always wanted to be someone in that role as a prosecutor specifically, who when people came into a courtroom, they knew that they were getting a fair and just approach to the prosecution of their case, and as a victim that they were going to be advocated for zealously. So I too went into this particular lane of work wanting to be the best advocate, whether it be as an attorney or whether it be victim advocate of the city of Philadelphia, that money cannot buy, because that's not an option. So that is why I went into this work. I too was a victim of crime growing up. So I always wanted to be the advocate that I didn't have. So when I was at the DA's office, I found it to be very gratifying to work on cases. My passion was family violence and sexual assault. That's where I got most of my jury trial experience. And I really did enjoy that work. However, I would always tell the folks that I worked with, whatever happens in this courtroom, and I too believe that I was amazing at my job, we both were great at our job, I can do whatever I can do in this courtroom. And whether we win, whether we lose, whether the jury hangs, whether you're happy with the outcome or not, when I say happy, I put that in air quotes, because obviously the happiness comes on the tail end of something horrible. Whatever happens in this courtroom, it does not change the fact that you will have to live your life tomorrow. You will have to live your life the day after that, the year after that. Your family has to go on. So what do we do about that piece? Because to me, and I would always tell them, while I hold myself in high regard, that's the real work that's meaningful. So I found myself becoming less and less enchanted with what was happening in the courthouse, because it was important, but it wasn't the most important thing. So when this opportunity became available, I really wanted to focus my efforts, my energy, my training, my passion, my skills, and my talents on that back end piece. How do we make it easier for those that have had this horrible experience to matriculate through the healing process with as much support as possible? Because unfortunately, a lot of the supports that are available are against Heather to some type of action happening. But that's not what helps you in the darkest hours of your process, right? So I wanted to be a part of that. So that's really important to this work.
Well, I graduated from high school early, and I was still a little bit of a rebellious teen. My mother wanted to know what I wanted to do. And I gave her a couple of different scenarios. I wanted to be a circus clown. I wanted to be a secretary. And finally, she said, you're going to go to nursing school and you can figure out what you want to do with the rest of your life. But you're going to nursing school. You're not going to waste your time, you know, sitting around doing nothing. And so I started nursing school and I fell in love with being a nurse. And that is what I've been. And now I'm training the next generation of nurses.
So we had a question from our Zoom. What do you want the community to know about the challenge of funding this work? And how can citizens influence an increase in funding and support for this work as well?
Well, the only thing I'll say, I think that's a better question geared towards Dara and her role. But I think that if there are citizens who are interested and wanted to work, it always helps to go to your legislator, go to your city council, go to the lawmakers, go to the individuals that are responsible for doing that. Because again, urgency. It's not urgent to them unless we make it urgent to them. But Adara, what are your thoughts?
I couldn't agree more, but I'll add a little bit more to it. I was recently in a meeting. Actually, Natasha, you and I were both in this meeting. And there was something that really quantified advocacy for me. And to me, quantifying advocacy has always come to the end, right? Like, did we get the thing we set out to get? But the person said, for legislators' offices, they add up a certain amount of text messages they receive in support of a particular thing, and a point goes to that thing. So let's say victim services right now, right? A point goes to that. The amount of phone calls they get, they add those up. Same topic, another point. Letters, add those up, another point. So I say all this to say that people look at those types of efforts. You know, we all get like the text messages and emails, contact your legislator to say that you care about this thing. And a lot of people, I know people are busy, right? You say, I'll get to it. Or you say, somebody else will do it or whatever. And we don't, right? But we know it's important. I don't think anybody in this room is sitting here because you don't think victim services is important or services to survivors of violence is important. But my point is, legislators listen to what people actually do. So if you only call about this topic, that's the only topic that's going to get the attention. So I would encourage folks to really get involved at that very granular level, because it all adds up and it equals to importance at a legislative level. And those folks take that into those conversations where they're voting on very important topics. So I would say that. I would say contacting legislators. I would say getting involved with whatever it is your passion is, particularly for this, you know, supporting your community-based agencies, being vocal when it comes to making comment at city council hearings on particular topics, because those are all available to us. And I'll be quite honest, prior to becoming a lawyer, I was living in Philadelphia. I had never watched a city council hearing in my entire life. But later in my career at the DA's office, when I became chief of the juvenile unit, it became very relevant to my actual work. And I started to watch them and I was like, wow, like you guys are really talking about like what happens for real in the city. This isn't like high level stuff. This is like, are we going to rename the street after whatever? Are we going to do this very little thing? And I began to realize that paying attention to those things and becoming active in those things really does matter. I mean, much like CPAC, my office was birthed out of a group of people saying we want this to exist and therefore we are here. So I would just say action, 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 and reaching out to the folks that make those voting decisions is extremely important.
So from my perspective, in terms of what we're doing, we're starting with building a pilot program with DCF&E. Myself and my co-authors around the algorithm that we've developed. And so we're looking for private funding to start. And then past that, if you are building something or starting out, you can't necessarily seek funding until you've actually established a pilot. You have some sort of results to speak to. So that's where we are. And then we'll look for additional funding past that, continuing to present our model, continuing to work with other disciplines on expanding the model outside of forensic nursing to make it a more balanced model for the victims of violence.
Actually, add another point. You're just talking about forensic nursing. That actually just reminded me of another thing that we've been working on as an office. And that is just like, and I'll start with this and then I'll get to the more detailed point. There's so much underfunding that it's hard to keep track of. There's underfunding as it pertains to what we've been discussing, which is money that goes directly into funding victim service agencies. There's underfunding when it comes to the reimbursement model for victims of crime when they're seeking reimbursement for funeral expenses, for relocation expenses, for crime scene cleanup expenses. There's also an issue when it comes to the caps because they're totally unrealistic and not rooted in the actual cost of anything in 2024, which is problematic. But also, just in thinking about forensic nursing, when the office was first opened, we were reached out to by PSARC, which is our local forensic exam location, to tell us that they barely have the funding to provide the medication for sexual assault victims to prevent all of the things we know that can happen after a sexual assault. Like, they aren't even funded to provide that. So like, that's just an example of the lack of funding that is available for such critical services. And that's the only location in the city and county of Philadelphia that provides those services to sexual assault victims. And they do not have enough money to provide medication on the back end of a sexual assault. It's wild. So like, those are the types of issues that we're facing. And we all, I think everyone can agree, right? Like, someone that's a victim of sexual assault deserves the medication to treat the things that could come. There's no money for that.
So first, I would like to just vouch for my former colleagues, Jolly and Adara. Absolutely were fantastic and phenomenal in their roles at the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. But my question is for the panel. I want to know if you all have heard about any potential innovative solutions in victim services around potentially introducing technology to make it more efficient and to streamline communication with victims, to make it easier for, you know, victims to upload receipts and all those types of things from, you know, potentially an app or something like that. And also the idea of allowing victims to have more say and voice in terms of policies and practices that are developed and implemented.
Thank you for that, Ebony. Thank you for your comment as well. As far as the technology and the work that I do, especially or particularly with CPOC, one of the things that we transitioned or changed or revolutionized is just the way in which individuals can file a complaint, because that in and of itself we have seen has been a barrier to actually filing a complaint. Again, when you had to go and file a complaint with the Philadelphia Internal Affairs Department, it's on something called Dungeon Road, which actually sounds like Dungeon Road, which is out in the Northeast, far Northeast, honestly, right? So again, now with CPOC, you have the option to come into the office in person physically to be there to file a complaint. But one of the things that we did, and again, it's a step in the right direction, I think, is we generated an online complaint procedure where they can then go in and now put in all of their information online. The staff will reach out to them. If they have additional information that they want to add to the complaint, they can do that. But if they put all of the information in there that they want to put in, that's it. And there's nothing additional that they would need to do when the investigation go from there and start from there. So that's just one thing, a small thing, but I've seen it be, although it's a small thing, a big hurdle to victims or individuals in general reporting following complaints. It's just because, listen, I've just been XYZ happened to me. Why do I got to come down? I have to go to this place. I have to go to that place. I have to take off from work, which is another thing. We talk about funding, but funding from another perspective when we talk about victimization, right, is the fact that if I have to go to a trial because I've been victimized, I don't get paid for work. If I don't have a job where I have vacation or sick or it's not even jury duty, right? It's you're going because you have to testify. I may not get paid from work. But that's another scenario. So in the spirit of that, we have developed that aspect of complaint reporting as far as technology.
So I guess what we're doing is innovative in that we've developed an algorithm for victims of law enforcement violence. We will be partnering with DCF&E office to roll it out and recruiting victims of law enforcement violence and refining the model. So not necessarily technology, but starting to address the gap in care.
And I think for our office, given that it's new, we've tried to think about how we could approach reaching folks and having folks reach us from any and everywhere. So we have a form on our website that allows folks to either A, ask for something that they need, or B, file a grievance of some sort with whomever. And then we reach out to them to say, you know, how can we help you? What is it that we need? And we're very adamant about the idea that you don't need to know what you need exactly. You just need to make the outreach and we'll figure it out together. So while that may not be super innovative in the sense it's not like an app or something super high technology, in the realm of what's available, it is more accessible than having folks come down to an office to fill out a piece of paper and whatnot. So that's one effort that we've taken. Our approach is that however you need to reach us is how you can reach us. So phone call, you want to come to the office, you can fill out the form, you can email us, whatever really works. But in addition to that, there have been some efforts on a statewide level to reach out to recipients of service by way of survey to figure out what is best, what's working, what's not working. Our office actually just did a survey within the city to figure out how folks want to receive information about victim services and how they want to be contacted versus how they don't want to be contacted. And we plan to implement that within our office. So that way we're reaching people with maximum efficiency, but also most importantly, in a trauma-informed way that they can receive. Because I think it's important that the folks that we engage with are not at their optimal in the moment that we're engaging with them. So it's important to be sensitive to that as we're working with them. And also thank you for the compliment.
Thank you for being here today. So I've lost two friends to homicides in Philadelphia, one of whom was a victim by someone who was in and out of the criminal justice system. How do we balance necessary progressive criminal justice reform with protecting future victims?
First of all, I'm so sorry for your loss. I'm sorry for your loss, but I think that what you said is balanced, where it has to be a balance, right? And you just really have to look at society and where we are in society and what things really need the attention of the criminal justice system. So the individual that is maybe stealing or committing retail theft for a baby formula probably doesn't need the same attention and resources from the criminal justice system as someone who has been in and out of the system. Another thing that has been talked about is the pipeline to prison. This is not necessarily about victimization, but about the pipeline to prison. As a prosecutor, one of the things that we would have to do is do guilty pleas and read a guilty plea colloquy. And part of the colloquy is, how far did you go in high school? Can you read and understand English? Can you write English? And far more than 50% of the time, the answers were, I did not graduate high school. I can understand English, but I can't write and I can't read it. So when we talk about balancing, I think you have to take a holistic approach. You have to look at what's done between the individual that starts out with that introductory crime versus to when they get there, right? What services did they receive in between? There's always an exception to the rule, but I don't think that an individual just starts out and goes out and says, they start their life and say, I want to hurt people. I want to commit crimes or that thing. So I think you have to look at everything that's done in between in order to determine how do you balance that.
So I agree, but also I will say that in terms of reviewing cases, and, you know, again, with candor, I am no longer with the district attorney's office, so I cannot speak for their policies or practices. But I will say that in terms of balancing the way that you handle criminal cases in terms of protecting the community, because that's what it ultimately comes down to, while also showing compassion, showing understanding, breaking down systemic racism and things that have placed people and created mass incarceration. I think you have to look, like Jali was saying, at the entire picture, but you also cannot create blanket policies with no regard for what's actually happening in front of us, right? Like, I don't think that you can look at every case and say everything that happens that fits this category, we're going to do this thing, because that thing may not work for everything that fits into this category, because the people are different. The circumstances are different. So you can't say this crime equals this thing, because that may not actually be what's necessary. And I think that's a part of what's missing when you talk about progressive policies versus keeping the community safe. It cannot be blanket rules, but it can't be, you know, sometimes we make this exception, sometimes we don't. It can't be haphazard. It has to be very thoughtful. But the most thought has to go towards keeping the community safe. And you can do that while also being compassionate to the things that have existed within our community that have created mass incarceration, which obviously needs to be addressed because it's rooted in a lot of different things, including racism and classism. But you also have to think about what the community needs to keep them safe. And that requires looking at things very more detailedly and not just looking at your ideology or your goal, because people's lives get lost when you do that. So I think that's what's been missing. And that's why, unfortunately, we've lost a lot of people to policies that are less than adequate and often reckless.
We're going to wrap up, but, you know, mindful of, like, we are speaking in front of a bunch of future public administrators. What is one thing from this discussion you would want folks to walk away with?
I think what comes to mind for me is starting in having worked with patients or victims of law enforcement for 20, 30 years as an emergency room nurse, and starting the work and developing the algorithm of care, and having over the past 3 years struggled within forensic nursing to even move it forward. What stands out for me is an old African proverb, and I'm not going to say it in the African language. The translation is, the struggle continues, victory is certain. Just continue, keep the work, doing the work.
I would say what I would want folks to take from this conversation is that there are people, programs, efforts, initiatives within the city that are rooted in helping the community. However, caveat, none of that means anything if we don't have the support, the funding, the ability to do the work that we want to do.
And while we may fight all day long and we may make it our life's work to advocate for this, the community has to demand more, because that's where people who have constituents, council members, state reps, legislators, that's where they put their money at, where their constituents say to put it at. So I would just encourage you all to hold the victim services and the needs of victims and survivors of violence to the same regard as criminal justice reform, as education, as all these other important things. I think we oftentimes think we have to pick a battle. And the truth of the matter is that we need to fight a lot of battles simultaneously with equal zeal. And this is one of them. So that is what I would add to this conversation. It is extremely important. People who are survivors of violence did not choose to be that. And they should not have to navigate that with limited resources and pennies, because that is not what they deserve. They deserve optimal medical care. They deserve optimal representation from district attorney's offices. They deserve to be dealt with integrity and compassion when it comes to law enforcement. But they also deserve resources to help them make their lives whole on the back end.
First, I would like to say thank you for having me here. The one very short and sweet thing that I would like to say, honestly, is be the change that you want to see. It is so universal and it crosses all professional lines and just throughout your life. If you be the change that you want to see, there will always be an advocate for victims. There will not always be an advocate for anything that it is that you put your mind.
I want to thank our panelists. Thank you so much, everyone. And thank you, Women of Fells.
Special thanks to Natasha Daniela DeLima McGlynn, Nicole Mahia, Adara Combs, Jolly Hatchett, Maya Anderson, Colleen Bonner, the Women of Fells, and the University of Pennsylvania's Fells Institute of Government for making this panel discussion possible, and to the Independence Public Media Foundation.
For more about Obscured and the rest of our work, keep up with us on social at Kuvenda Media.
Obscured's From Words to Weapons series is produced by Kuvenda Media and mixed by Brad Linder. Malik Calhoun composed the music for this episode and the rest of our series.
Special thanks to Obscured's fiscal sponsor, Media Alliance, which is one of the oldest media change organizations in the United States and helps our podcast receive tax-deductible contributions. And we're grateful to Obscured's founding supporters who've made donations to support our journalism initiative.
You can help more people discover Obscured by leaving us a review on your favorite podcast app and sharing it with others.
I'm Stephanie Marudis, Kuvenda Media's executive producer and Obscured's co-creator.
And I'm Emily Previty, executive editor and co-creator of Obscured. Thanks for listening.